So, and thanks, Joanna, as always, for, you know, being so supportive with logistics. So I thought maybe the best use of our time today would be to think a little bit about the Parshios that we've been reading, especially since we haven't had the opportunity to meet since we began reading the book of Shmos, the third Parsha of which we'll read this week, and then thinking about that in conjunction with very significant anniversary today, which is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, which, you know, on its own definitely warrants a few minutes of consideration. This is, after all, the Parsha where we derive, there are different source texts for it, but where we derive the mitzvah, the ultimate mitzvah of remembrance, of Zachor Esayom Hazeh, Asher Yitzasam Mitzrayim Beis Avadim, V'igat Levincha Bayom Ahu Lemor, historical memory, is really at the essence of, you know, who we are as a people. And we should note that, of course, is meant to be understood as a very profound contrast with Egyptian society. V'lo Zachar Esar HaMashkim Es Yosef, V'yakom Melech Hadash HaMitzrayim Asher Lo Yada Es Yosef. The Egyptians are people who forget, sometimes deliberately so, about the past, and we're people who very much perpetuate historical memory. We see it as significant in many different respects. You don't have to look past the opening psukim of this week's parsha to understand that it's not just one generation, but it's actually multiple generations. L'man tisaper be'oznei b'incha uven b'incha eis asher hisalalti b'mitzrayim. The idea of not just parents and children, but even parents and grandparents and grandchildren is very much the Torah ethos of remembrance. I wanted to approach this from a couple of different perspectives. First, by giving just a very brief summary and distillation of some of the very haunting parallels between Shibud Mitzrayim and the incredible Chorban that our people suffered in the last century. You know, in retrospect, especially since the yeshiva is studying Sefer Shmos this year, some of these things really are haunting. There's no other word for it. For example, we know that the first person in the Torah to refer to the Jewish people as an independent nation is Paro. Hine am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzum imenu, right? The idea of defining the Jewish people categorically as the other and as a threat was something without which Shibud Mitzrayim would never have been possible, right? Paro was literally the first person to say they are a nation, and that is to say they are a threat to us. They are a nation that is different than our nation. The Pasuk says, Vayomer el Amo, he says to his nation, Hine am b'nei Yisrael. And if you've studied any genocide, especially the Holocaust, but it's not unique even to the Holocaust, that the history of genocide is always predicated on defining a particular group as the other. So Paro's chiddush, as it were, to describe the Jewish people as an Am, again, it's the first time that it happens in the Torah, is a very significant moment, number one. Number two, the beginning, again, with Paro's propaganda that the Jewish people are, instead of just, you know, reflecting the actual historical record, which is that they had been a great source of blessing to Egypt. You don't even need to resort to Midrashim here, which say that Yaakov's arrival stopped the famine. But even if you don't go that far and you just focus on the simple meaning of the text, right, Yosef certainly played a major role contributing to Egyptian society and civilization and the welfare of the Egyptian people. It was only back in Parshas Vayigash that they were saying about Yosef, Vayomru Hech Isanu, that you've saved us, you've given us life. Paro, of course, in the propaganda that, you know, Jewish people are somehow some terrible and grave threat to the Egyptians, and that there's going to be a war, Vayaki Sikrena Milchama V'nosaf Kamu Al Sonenu V'nolcham Banu V'alam Min Haaretz, that there would be going to be some kind of a war of annihilation. You know, it's either us or them. That kind of a language is obviously, people know the history of the 1930s, so that was not implicit, but that was something that the leadership of Nazi Germany also quite explicitly spoke about, is a war of annihilation. And it's either going to be the annihilation of the German people or the annihilation of what was referred to as international Jewry or Jewish Bolshevism, depending. If some of you heard some of the speeches last week at Yad Vashem, when they were marking the 75th anniversary, these themes were discussed over and over again, with the idea of a war of annihilation, that it's either us or them, That comes straight out of these psukim, number two. Number three, Parah's statement, Hava Nischak Malo, about using subterfuge and deception. Nazi Germany really, you know, developed this to, you know, its most extreme conclusion. There was a euphemism for everything. Deportations, resettlement, everybody here knows, I don't need to go through the list, but special treatment instead of, you know, mass murder. The Ramban develops this point very profoundly. The Ramban says, you know, Paro was very careful not to be directly associated with a genocide. And so, you know, the first thing that Paro wanted to do was to, you know, say, okay, it's just a matter of doing some labor. You know, it's not going to be anything more than that. And then he told the Mialdos very privately what they should do. And then even when he went to the Egyptian people, he made sure that it was not associated with the state. Vayomer, when Paro said, "Kolaben ha'ilod ha'yorat ha'shichu," that they should kill all the Jewish boys. It's, the Ramban points out, it's interesting, he didn't tell his army. He didn't tell the people that you would normally expect him to tell. He wanted there to be what we would call today plausible deniability. And that, of course, harkens back to, you know, for all of their punctilious record-keeping, the Germans were extremely careful not to put into direct writing what exactly they were doing. We only know about the ultimate implementation of the final solution. The Wannsee conference, one copy was saved, one copy. They collected all the copies after Heydrich chairs the meeting where he says, we're actually going to set up, you know, what became the death camps of Belzec and Chelmno and Sobibor and Auschwitz, of course. One copy survived, and they were very careful, Hava Nischak Malo, not to put their fingerprints on it directly. So again, you know, we see so many very important and I think very haunting parallels when we simply look at the trajectory of Shibud Mitzrayim and the tactics that were used. And this is exactly the playbook that was followed in more recent calamities. Point number two, and this is something that I think is often not fully developed and more easily overlooked. Sometimes we think about what happened with the Egyptians and the Jews is a very binary thing, you know, the bad Egyptians and the good Jews. But it's more complicated than that in both directions. It's a hard thing to say. It comes up both at the beginning of Parshas Beshalach, but it's also alluded to in this week's Parsha as well, in the context of Makas Choshech. Rashi makes the same point in both places, V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael meretz Yisrael, and also in his explanation of what Makas Choshech was for. Rashi indicates that the vast majority of Jews really did not warrant redemption. Rashi takes a position in Parshas Beshalach that 20% of the Jews emerged from Egypt. If you look at the original source, the primary source that Rashi is quoting from, that happens to be the most optimistic of the views. But the other views there are not 20%, but either 2% or 0.2%, one of every 500. So if 20% sounds bad, Rashi was taking it easy on us. The Jews were not all the same. And that's important to think about. Perhaps even more controversially, the Egyptians weren't all the same either. It wasn't just evil Egyptians, but just as we know very well about the idea of Chasidei Umot HaOlam, let's not forget that Yetzias Mitzrayim would have never gotten off the ground had it not been for what we would call today Chasidei Umot HaOlam. Let's start with, of course, Bas Paro, right? She's as close to the architect of the genocide as possible. But yet her humanity is somehow not corrupted, as the Pasuk says, Vatachmolalav, Vatomer Mialde Haivrim Zeh, that she had compassion. There was something that was alive inside of her in terms of just seeing an infant for being the innocent human life that it is and not snuffing that out. And even after she had the opportunity to think it over, it wasn't just in the spur of the moment, but Vayihi Lalavain, she raised him as her son. And she celebrated that moment. She calls him Moshe, Kimina Maya Mishisiu, that incredible moment where she brought life to this child. She didn't harbor the child, she didn't give birth to the child, but she did give life to the child. And that becomes his name. And the Medrash famously says that, you know, Moshe may have had other Jewish names, all kinds of different ideas, Tovia, Victor, whatever. But we call him Moshe because we cherish that moment, and God says, you know, we have to be Makir Tov to those who were good to us. It wasn't only Bas Paro, of course. The Mialdos, there's a dispute amongst the Rishonim whether they were Jewish or not. I think people tend to know Rashi's view that he thinks that they were Jewish. The simple pshat is probably that they weren't Jewish, and there's a lot of evidence in that direction. It probably makes a little bit more sense for Paro to ask non-Jewish women to carry out that particularly heinous task. But what the Torah says is very striking. V'tirena ha-mialdos esha Elokim doesn't say the proper name of Hashem, Yud, then Hey, then Vav, then Hey, the name that's used within the Jewish context, but they have a sense that there is a God that they have to answer to. V'lo asu kasher diber alehen melech Mitzrayim v'techayena as hayiladim. And that should be remembered also. That is to say, there was individual choice on both sides. There was individual choice on the Jewish side, and there was individual choice on the Egyptian side. And even when we think about a place like Auschwitz, there were people who acted, of course, the vast majority with unspeakable cruelty. And then there were people who saved. There were people who made choices. And a place like Auschwitz, if nothing else, reveals in the absolute core who a person is. As it was the case in Sefer Shmos and Shibud Mitzrayim, we now know, and it's all documented at Yad Vashem, about the Chasidei Umot HaOlam and people who, at grave personal risk, took the step of making decisions that would ultimately save people. I'm sure some of you have read the literature that's recently come out about that. It's an ongoing process. It's an ongoing process of discovery, and so that's always important to remember. Is that as crushing as the circumstances were, that there were still very important individual choices being made, both in Mitzrayim and more recently in Auschwitz and throughout Europe, in terms of what people decided to do and how people decided to behave. And this is a hard thing, but just to give a very specific example about that, the first parsha of Sefer Shmos, so the very end, Moshe and Aaron go to Paro for the first time, and it doesn't go well. Paro is just kind of enraged by the whole thing, and Moshe and Aaron trying to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people, and he's annoyed why they're doing this. Lama Moshe v'Aaron tafriu es ha'amim ha'asav. He's very dismissive, almost sneering at what it is that they're saying, that the Jewish people should be able to express themselves spiritually or religiously. Lo yadati es Hashem, I have no idea who you're talking about. Right, very scornful. V'gam es Yisrael lo ashaleach, and even if I did, I wouldn't let you take my slave laborers away. It actually gets much worse for the Jews. Right, we know that Paro says, as a penalty for this, for this request, the Jews have to produce the same quota of bricks, but they're not going to be given the raw materials, which means they have to spend now X number of hours collecting the raw materials, the straw, which will then mix with mud, and they'll be able to make bricks. And of course they're not able to produce it, right? Because the quota was set up on the basis that they'd be given the raw materials. And the pasuk says, Vayuku shotrei b'nei Yisrael, that the way that the basic slavery worked, which again is just directly parallel to the way that things worked in the camps, was that the Jewish slaves worked under sort of Jewish individuals who then were under Egyptian supervisors. So the term for that in the camps would have been kapos, and the term for that in the chumash is shotrei v'nei Yisrael. And the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that the shotrei v'nei Yisrael, they were the ones who took the beatings. They didn't pass it on to the Jews. They made remarkable choices. And as a result of that, Chazal tell us that they merited great things later on, that they merited becoming a Sanhedrin later on in Sefer Bamidbar. But whatever it is that they merited, they didn't merit, right? They demonstrated enormous personal courage. Vayuku shotrei v'nei Yisrael, that they were beaten because of this, because the Jews weren't producing the quota. And the Torah makes it very clear that they did not then take out that abuse on the Jews who were enslaved. And there were some people in the camps who acted similarly, but there were plenty of people who didn't. And that's also part of the history. There are people making choices. And those choices are very defining. I remember a very close congregant of mine when I was an intern and assistant rabbi. I did get to know his father. This was in Manhattan. His father is a survivor and is a very wonderful, wonderful man, Mr. Kalfas. And he stopped a lynching in Bergen-Belsen immediately after the war. There was a particularly cruel capo, and he was going to be lynched by the people that he tortured. In other words, by Jewish people who, the SS ran away, but he was there and he had been brutal and very cruel, and he was very proud to say that he stopped it. And he said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to be the people that the Germans wanted to turn us into. He saved that man's life. Now, whether that man deserved to be saved or not, as a moment of great humanity, people make choices. And even when, it's the easiest to sort of pin whatever is going on the surroundings. Well, what do you expect me to do? It's, Shibud Mitzrayim. What do you expect me to do? It's the Holocaust. It's important to remember that in all kinds of directions, people made choices. Egyptians made choices, and Jewish people made choices, and Germans made choices, and Europeans made choices. Jewish people made choices, and some of them were very noble, and some were very ignoble. And Al Tadin es Chavercha Chetegi Adam Komo, nobody can judge, who wasn't there. But that's also a major part of the remembrance of today. Third and finally, in the opening series of Psukim, the beginning of last week's Parsha, are understood by the Gemara and Sanhedrin to be a very strident critique, let's say, of Moshe. I just recounted the episode, so Moshe and Aaron go to Paro, and Paro is not receptive at all to their message, and things become worse for the Jewish people. And Moshe, to quote from the Gemara, "Hitiach dvarim klape mala," he spoke in a way that we don't really speak to God, and he says, "Lama hariosa, lama zeh shlachtani." What were you thinking, forcing me to go? Remember, Moshe didn't exactly volunteer for the job. That's an understatement. God forced him into it, and as soon as he goes, right, not only is the Jewish people not saved, hatzelo hitzalta samecha, but things got much worse, and Moshe was very angry about it. And the opening sequence, this is the way that the Gemara at the end of Masechta Sanhedrin interprets it, of Parshas Va'era is about that conversation. Va'era l'Avraham l'Yitzchak l'Yaakov v'kel Shakai u'shmi Hashem lo nodati lahem. That there's this unfavorable comparison that's made between Moshe and the Avos, that God basically says to Moshe, this is the citation here, chaval al da'avdin u'dolom b'shtakhin, woe for those who are no longer here, and they haven't really been replaced. In other words, the Avos, they had all kinds of, issues they could have taken up with me, Tainas. I told Avram, let's say, Kivi Yitzchak Ikari Lechazara, and then I told him, Ve'alayu Sham Li'olah L'Chadarim Asher Amari Lecha, and Avram's not in the business of saying, then, why did you give me this son, and other things with Yitzchak, and other things with Yaakov. And I basically promised them, the Gemara says, Yiftachtim v'lo kiyamtim. And I never really fulfilled my promises, not in their lifetime. And, here you are, and if you would just wait, a little bit, it's going to be within a year. It only took a year for the entire process to unfold. You're going to see, Ata tira, Esa shir asa lefaro, ki v'yad chazakai yisholchem, v'yad chazakai yigarshim yaretzo. We just have a little bit of patience. There are people that waited their whole lives, and they've lived and died without seeing promises fulfilled, and you, Moshe, you can't deal with a little bit of adversity. That's what the Gemara is. It's a very strident critique of Moshe in his early career, in his early leadership. I think about that Gemara all of the time. When I think about the people who we lost. Now, again, today we're remembering Auschwitz in particular. So, about 1.1 million people died in Auschwitz, and about 950,000 Jews died in Auschwitz. About 470,000 of them were Hungarian Jews, about 300,000 Polish Jews, 70,000 French Jews, some miscellaneous grouping. But, we could reasonably extend it, not just to the 950,000 of Auschwitz, but, you know, the other 5/6 of the Jewish people that did not survive. I always think about it from the perspective of this Gemara. You know, here we are sitting in 2020, and, you know, we've seen many promises fulfilled that they did not see. We've seen, we'll get to Israel in a second. There was never in a millennia of Jewish civilization in Europe, for all of its achievements, spiritual achievements, cultural achievements, there was never a diaspora that could even begin to compare it to what the Jewish people have experienced in the United States in terms of safety, in terms of security, in terms of material success, in terms of the number, the sheer number of people who are involved in the study of Torah Volozhin. Again, I'm not getting into quality issues here for a different time, but at the height of Volozhin, you had 400 people in the yeshiva. You know, if you go to Lakewood, so, you know, some, you know, satellite of a satellite of a satellite of the major, you know, yeshiva in Lakewood has 400 people. Unimaginable thing. They never saw that. We've seen many things. And then you get to the state of Israel, right? People who went to Treblinka in 1942 and 1943, they never saw the promises fulfilled. And here we are. And we've seen much fulfilled, both here and in Israel. Things that I imagine they would have been deeply moved to see, things that would have been very, very meaningful for them. So as we experience these promises fulfilled, and I'm not saying you know we're in the Messianic era. Only God knows when that is and what that looks like exactly. But we've seen many things that they did not merit seeing. We should think about it from their point of view. They tragically were taken from this world without seeing many of these things. And so when we experience them, we should be both, A, very grateful to be living in a time that we're living in with all of its challenges, and B, to remember that we have a duty and obligation not only to ourselves and not only to God, but to them as well, to carry forward what they were unable to finish. Rav Lichtenstein always used to like to say to pick up the baton. This is in his own inimitable formulation, better than I could, to pick up the baton that was struck from their hands and to try to carry that forward, to redouble our efforts in whatever our area is. We're obviously all connected to Jewish education. Jewish education in a post-Holocaust world is not the same as Jewish education in the pre-Holocaust world, because it has a what we would call in Gemarish here, we would say there are two dinim. It's Jewish education. It's valuable in its own right, but it's also, there's a second din. It's rebuilding the Jewish people. Everything that happens in this building today and every institution of Jewish education is another brick in the edifice of the rebuilding of the Jewish people. It has to be thought of in those terms. We might not think about that every day, but from a historical point of view, 500 and 1,000 years from now, anybody who would be looking back on people living today would think about us as the people who were rebuilding from the greatest, quantitatively speaking, calamity in Jewish history. And it doesn't hurt us, at least on occasion, to remind ourselves to think a little bit in those terms also. We all have much work to do because so much was taken. So in that respect, you know, we could think about the 75th anniversary, and I think pretty much everything that I said I could have said, you know, at the 73rd or 72nd or 71st. I think that's all true. So I just wanted to conclude by noting, you know, we're obviously living in a time of resurgence of anti-Semitism. That's not news to anybody in this room. That's documented in statistics, not just in the United States and in Europe, but the world over. Now, it's important to note, and the historians around the table will I hope agree with this, that much of this was inevitable, right? That there was an anomaly after the Holocaust of a dip of anti-Semitism. The guilt and shame was so profound. So anti-Semitism is always going to come back in some level, but that process has been dramatically accelerated. And it's been accelerated basically by three things. economic dislocation. There's been enormous economic dislocation, even in the United States. If you go back to 2008, there are people, you can look at the overall unemployment and GDP, but there are people who never recovered. There's an entire generation of people in economic despair that was lost to opioids. It's a very serious phenomenon, number one. Number two, social media. We talked before about propaganda, but social media is basically like the vasculature through which the poison of hatred is circulated in society. So if you sit across the table from somebody, I don't care how different your points of view are, you'll walk away, you know, saying, oh, this person is, you know, they're not that different from me, actually. They have a family and they have these concerns, right? If you're just sort of subtweeting at them. So it's like an avatar. And that inherently is very dangerous. It's terrible for society and drives people further and further into corners. And that, of course, is the second factor. And then the third factor is that, you know, there's been a kind of a sanctioning of nativism and xenophobia. And so, like, you know, if a fire doesn't have oxygen, it just burns out. So anti-Semitism basically thrives in an environment where people of any group are stigmatized. So if, you know, you have people saying, let's go kill all the Martians, let's go kill all the Hispanics, let's go get, you know, all the Muslims. So whatever it is. So that's exactly the context in which it's easy to say, well, let's just go after another group, right? So it's not like some great surprise. And we have to be very sensitive to that. We're supposed to learn things from history. The Torah says many times that because we suffered in Egypt, because we were abused, we should not become abusers. Torah was aware that that was a possibility, but we should become more sensitive to people who are likely targets of abuse. People like orphans and widows, people who are what they call the Ger, the Yasam, the Almana. So the same thing is true, you know, post Auschwitz, right? So if we suffered, if we were targeted, so then we should be very sensitive when you hear groups being pointed out, right? Not individuals, not given chance to, you know, be evaluated as people. Are there, like we talked about before, are their actions righteous or evil? But simply based on their group identity, that's really the context in which anti-Semitism thrives, because you just replace group X with group Y. It doesn't take very long to get. And words become actions very quickly, right? It's not like, you know, you don't need me to tell you that it was only 14 months between Charlottesville and Pittsburgh, right? It doesn't take that long. So, you know, you have people chanting, Jews will not replace us, and then somebody, you know, gets an idea, oh, okay, you know, guess you're right, right? And there are enough people in any society that are disaffected for that to be the case. So there's additional resonance today. I think it's always worth remembering. Like I said, we could have talked about this at the 70th anniversary, but things have changed a lot since then. You know, in every shul and every yeshiva, we'll fight the symptoms of anti-Semitism. We'll get Department of Homeland Security grants. We'll get more guards. We'll get more doors. We'll get more money. We'll get more ammunition. And we'll spare no effort. So we're to the shul, that's what the people are responsible to the school. But that's only fighting the symptoms. That's not fighting anti-Semitism. That's just saying, you know, so God forbid they should try to. Right, yeah, exactly. But if you want to really fight the disease itself, so you have to get into this much more difficult space of talking about, you know, intolerance and hatred and what breeds that. And that's a much more difficult, that takes a lot more courage to do. That's a very unpopular thing to do, especially in certain circles, is to identify that for what it is. But we do have a responsibility, that we do have a responsibility to do that. And hopefully, you know, this is it's a tough thing, but it's a battle worth fighting, because it's really not only a battle for the soul of this country, which it definitely is, but it's a battle for our own, ultimately, our own safety and security. If we're going to live in an environment, in an ambient context, where people literally are at each other's throats on both sides, there's going to be violence. Words translated into speech, we just talked about that. So we have a great responsibility, especially as the people are most directly impacted by what happened at Auschwitz, 950,000 out of 1.1 million, to remind ourselves and the world constantly of the messages of hatred, of irrational hatred based on group identity. Hine am b'nei Yisrael, Paro said. Once you identify them as a group, it's all downhill from there. Okay, so we should remember those who were lost, and even more importantly, honor them as kedoshim, by carrying forward the message that they're not here to articulate for themselves.